In 1603, Sir Walter Raleigh was accused of conspiracy to commit treason against the crown in England by attempting to overthrow King James and replace him with his cousin, Arabella Stuart, as Queen of England. At trial, the primary evidence against Raleigh was a sworn confession by his alleged accomplice, Lord Corbum, implicating Raleigh in the scheme. But at trial, both Raleigh and the crown had cards up their sleeves.
Raleigh had walked into that chamber, one of the most hated men in Britain, and by the end of the day, he had his enemies eating out of his hand. It helped that he had a talent for drama, such as his ending flourish when he produced a new secret confession written by Cobham that exonerated Raleigh. But impressive as Raleigh's hand was, he'd overplayed it. With what we can only imagine was the slyest smile in history, the judge produced an even newer confession from Cobham that basically said, LOL, the confession I gave to Raleigh is fake, he's totally guilty. And with that, Walter Raleigh realized that his ace in the hole had been nothing more than a dog-eared joker. That same day, Raleigh was convicted and sentenced to death, a penalty to be carried out as swiftly and as nastily as possible.
The verdict was criticized by citizens and scholars alike, eventually leading to laws requiring the accused be able to challenge their accuser face-to-face. And in turn, that eventually led to the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution creating the Confrontation Clause, which gives criminal defendants the right to confront their accusers. Such accusers can come in many stripes. Eyewitnesses, bad character witnesses, and yes, medical examiners who claim that defendants committed homicide. As we noted last episode, Dr. Charles Siebert performed the autopsy of Adriana Hutto. But after his conclusions were torn to shreds during a deposition, he fled Florida and found refuge in New Jersey. This then led the state to use a surrogate medical examiner to sort through Siebert's findings and try to testify at trial. What this meant was that Amanda Lewis could not confront the medical examiner accusing her of homicide. And what this also means is that Amanda should have been released from prison more than a decade ago. So why is she still behind bars, and what does our own medical examiner have to say after reviewing this case almost two decades later?
Hi and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice, The State versus Amanda Lewis. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller, a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. This is the seventh episode of our deep dive series into the trial of Amanda Lewis. In 2008, Amanda was convicted of the 2007 drowning death of her 7-year-old daughter, Adriana Hutto. She's been in prison ever since.
Let's start by resetting the scene. On August 8, 2007, 7-year-old Adriana Hutto drowned in the family's above-ground, soft-sided pool. 2 days later, Bay County Medical Examiner Charles Siebert performed an autopsy on her, and he was assisted in the autopsy by his Director of Investigations, Lisa Ruckman, who had no medical training or even a college degree. During the autopsy, Ruckman saw the bruising on Adriana's face and forehead, lined her left hand up with the bruises, and came to the conclusion that Amanda had drowned Adriana with her left hand.
I placed my hand over the bruises, and as you can see on the side of the cheek here, it lined up perfectly with the side of my left thumb. This would be the index finger where it lined up, my middle finger, ring finger, and then either one of these two smaller bruises matched where my pinky would be. And the ball of my hand was consistent with that. The mark that was on the bridge of the nose, it did seem to fit.
Meanwhile, Dr. Siebert saw what he characterized as bruising on the back of Adriana's head. And so, combining Ruckman's experiment with what he saw as bruises on the back of Adriana's head, he came up with this conclusion. In his mind, Dr. Siebert imagined Adriana being drowned in a concrete in-ground pool. And so the way he saw it, Amanda was on the ground outside the pool, pushing Adriana's face against the concrete bottom of the shallow end of the pool. That would then explain both the bruising on the front and back of Adriana's head. As we noted last episode, all of this led to a rude awakening during Dr. Siebert's deposition weeks before the trial, when he learned that the pool was above ground and soft-sided. Again, here's a clip from coverage of Amanda's trial by True Crime with Aphrodite Jones.
Given the other attacks on his credibility, was it possible Siebert had made mistakes in this case too? Walter Smith believed it was. Smith deposed him just weeks before the trial. He asked the doctor to clarify his view of two injuries identified in his report.
Our medical examiner opined that her face was held on the bottom of the pool, causing the injury to the back of the head. And then when he was informed this is not a concrete pool, this is just a rubber inflatable pool, he really didn't have any explanation for that injury.
If the bottom of the pool was too soft to have caused the injuries, Smith didn't think the facial bruises could have been made there either.
How would you have an object there to press against in order to get enough force to cause the bruising?
Yeah, I don't know if it's possible. It doesn't look like from this picture that you could actually reach the bottom of the pool. I don't know.
And then, as we've said, Dr. Siebert fled Florida and refused to appear at Amanda's trial. And so the prosecution had to bring in a surrogate medical examiner to review Dr. Siebert's records and testify at trial. That doctor was pathologist Dr. Andrea Minyard, who became the interim Bay County medical examiner after Dr. Siebert was fired.
Good morning. Will you introduce yourself to the jury?
My name is Dr. Andrea Minyard. I'm the chief medical examiner for District 1 and then the interim chief medical examiner for District 14.
It's fairly easy to see how this hamstrung the defense. Why? Well, recall how the defense dismantled Dr. Siebert's theory during deposition by showing him that the pool was above ground and soft-sided. By way of contrast, here was the entirety of defense counsel's cross-examination of Dr. Minyard when she was initially called to testify at trial.
Well, Dr. Minyard, you said you had the statement of a credible witness to support a conclusion that this death occurred via homicide. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Is that credible witness A.J. Hutto?
Yes, sir.
Nothing further.
Now, in fairness, Dr. Minyard was later recalled as a witness, leading to a few more questions. But that's only because the prosecution called Lisa Ruckman to testify to her hand theory. And, of course, we know that Dr. Siebert's mistaken belief that the pool was concrete was critical to him combining the bruises on the front of the face to the bruises on the back of Adriana's head and come to the conclusion about how Amanda drowned her daughter. Prosecutor Larry Basford did not broach the subject of the bruises on the back of Adriana's head when he initially called Dr. Minyard to testify, and here you can hear him trying to steer her away from the topic when she brought it up on her own.
And there's no way of looking at this right here and I suppose and actually saying what actually caused this bruise, these two bruises here.
No, there's no way I can tell what causes a bruise. Bruises can leave behind a pattern, but the injuries here, while they are in consistent with a pattern that I believe, I can't say for sure that that's what caused them. The ones on the back of the head, they don't have a pattern. Just the ones on the forehead sort of have a pattern. So the ones on the back of the head, I couldn't tell you.
No.
They look consistent with just the head being forcefully hit against a surface.
Now, we'll come back to these in just a moment, ma'am, but there were some other injuries that were noted on Adriana.
Yes.
Could you discuss those with us?
But despite what Basford said, no, he did not return to the topic of the supposed bruises on the back of Adriana's head. And it's clear to see why. The bruises Dr. Siebert described in his autopsy report are consistent with Adriana's head being hit against a hard surface. But as we've noted, and as Dr. Siebert learned during his deposition, the pool did not have hard surfaces. And so why would the prosecution focus on a critical part of Dr. Siebert's conclusion that was inconsistent with a crime scene? Now, as noted, Dr. Minyard was recalled as a witness after Lisa Ruckman testified to her hand theory. And defense counsel's cross-examination of her was still brief, a little under 2 minutes long. But it did bring up an important point that would explain why Amanda's murder conviction should have been reversed based on Dr. Minyard's testimony. Specifically, defense counsel's cross-examination dealt with a possible alternate source for Adriana's bruises.
Are you familiar with a manure fork?
No, sir.
You don't know what that is? It's an instrument with prongs on it that uses to shovel manure.
sort of like a pitchfork?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So if an instrument like that struck her in the face, it could also cause that type of pattern.
The instrument could strike her on the face and cause a similar pattern. However, the bruising would not be on the back of the head from that same instrument.
Well, how do you know there's bruising on the back of the head?
The photographs during the autopsy.
Okay, that shows hemorrhage, doesn't it?
No, sir, it shows contusions of the undersurface of the back of the scalp, as I showed earlier on the pictures.
Okay, and what color were those bruises?
They appeared, at least in the pictures, to be dark red.
Dark red. And did Dr. Siebert ever examine those bruises from the outside? Did he shave the hair and look at the coloration on the outside?
No, not to my knowledge.
Thank you.
This is then the heart of the issue. Were there actually bruises on the back of Adriana's head? Yes, Dr. Siebert said there were, but we know from the Martin Lee Anderson case and his other work that Dr. Siebert often got this type of thing wrong based upon not doing the type of work a pathologist must perform. And so were these bruises or hemorrhages or something else entirely? This was the question at the heart of testimony by pathologist Edward Willey, who testified for the defense. Again, he testified remotely, meaning that the so-called battle of the experts in this case was between two experts who weren't in the courtroom, Dr. Siebert and Dr. Willey. And the bad audio you're about to hear is the same bad audio that the jurors heard in the courtroom.
Dr. Siebert also noticed what he called a hemorrhage on the back of the head. That's further on page 3, where he describes that injury. Is that the same thing as a bruise?
Yes, he doesn't actually indicate how big that is. It's hard to know whether that's a bruise or whether that's just blood settling out there in the postmortem interval, because it's in the back, and bodies are usually placed on their back to be stored.
So he calls it a focal ganglion hemorrhage.
Right.
Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
And does that have any special significance to you, or are you able to?
No, if it were very large, I think he probably mentioned the size of it. He doesn't mention the size of it, so I think it's probably relatively small and probably doesn't have a great significance.
Okay. Now, in his deposition, he relates the injuries to the face, particularly the forehead, with the injury to the back of the head. And I just for your reference, he talks about it on page 12 of his deposition.
Okay. Take a look here. Significant, but it does indicate that there's force on the face of the back of the head against something. It's difficult for me to visualize how he intends that to be taken, because there are pictures of this pool, and it's a relatively flexible, inflated pool, so there isn't a hard surface to push on, and it's hard to imagine pushing on the face and being able to reach all the way to the bottom of the pool. The bottom of the pool is a number of feet from the surface. I just don't visualize how these are related.
Now, in case you didn't catch all that, let's unpack it. First, Dr. Willey testified that what Dr. Siebert characterized as bruising or hemorrhaging on the back of Adriana's head was likely lividity. As you might recall from our Nonsaid series, that's blood pooling in the parts of the body that are closest to the ground and staining the skin after death. And second, Dr. Willey explained that Dr. Siebert's theory that this alleged bruising came from Adriana's head being pushed against a hard surface made no sense, given that the pool was soft-sided and flexible. Therefore, third, as Dr. Siebert noted, whether this was bruising, hemorrhaging, or lividity, It was likely unrelated to the bruising on Adriana's face. This was helpful for the defense, but fundamentally different from being able to dismantle Dr. Siebert in front of the jurors through cross-examination. Instead, Dr. Willey and the state's surrogate medical examiner were left trying to sort through the wreckage of Dr. Siebert's career. As an evidence professor, this was especially distressing because I immediately knew that Dr. Minder testifying as a surrogate for Dr. Siebert was a violation of Amanda's constitutional right to confrontation. But I also knew that the issue had been waived because it hadn't been raised in prior appeals. So let's break all that down. The Confrontation Clause can be violated in two main ways. The first is when a witness testifies at trial and the defense isn't allowed to cross-examine her. The second is when a witness makes certain out-of-court statements that are admitted at trial despite the witness not testifying at trial. But what types of statements are covered by the Confrontation Clause? Crawford versus Washington is the critical Supreme Court case. It was decided back in 2003, 5 years before Amanda's trial. Crawford involved the admission of a witness's statements to a police officer against a criminal defendant despite the witness not testifying at trial. Here are the pertinent portions of the Supreme Court's opinion delivered by then Chief Justice Rehnquist.
The Sixth Amendment was adopted to protect against particular abuses that had occurred in England. The most notable example was the trial of Sir Walter Raleigh in 1603, where the Crown's evidence consisted almost entirely of an accomplice's out-of-court confession implicating Raleigh. English law developed a right of confrontation to guard against these abuses, and the Sixth Amendment made that right part of our Constitution. This history suggests that the Sixth Amendment was directed primarily at particular kinds of out-of-court statements, such as examinations by government officers out of the presence of the defendant. Sylvia's interrogation by the police falls squarely within this core class of testimonial statements. Where testimonial statements are at issue, the only index of reliability sufficient to satisfy constitutional demands is the one the Constitution actually prescribes, confrontation.
So when is a statement testimonial, triggering the Confrontation Clause? According to the Supreme Court, a statement is testimonial when it was, quote, made under circumstances which would lead an objectively reasonable declarant to believe or anticipate that this statement would be available for use against an accused at a later trial. From this, it's pretty clear that statements by forensic scientists should be testimonial as well, triggering the Confrontation Clause. And indeed, in its opinion in Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts, the Supreme Court concluded that a forensic laboratory report stated that an unknown substance was cocaine qualified as testimonial evidence to which the Confrontation Clause applies.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, we're going to take a quick ad break, and I just want to explain something to you about why it's so important for you guys to support our sponsors. You might not know this, but all these years, all the work we have done for all of the defendants whose cases we reinvestigate and cover has been pro bono. We don't charge them or their families or their lawyers a dime. And the only way we can afford to do this, which this is work that would ordinarily cost a defendant hundreds of thousands of dollars, the only way we can afford to do this is because of our sponsors. So we are so grateful to our sponsors, and we are grateful to all of you. If you want to know what you can do to help support our work, support our sponsors. Thank you so much. If you are still overpaying for wireless, it's time to say yes to saying no. At Mint Mobile, their favorite word is no. You've got no contracts, no monthly bills, no overages, no hidden fees, no BS. Here is why I said yes to making the switch and getting premium wireless for just $15 a month. I've got kids who need mobile phones. They want data. They want fast speed internet. They want to connect to all their friends. And when you get a family plan like that, it costs a lot of money. But I have saved hundreds by switching over to Mint Mobile without sacrificing sacrificing any of the quality of any of the other services, because all of Mint Mobile's plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, and it's delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. No more overpriced wireless and their jaw-dropping monthly bills, which, by the way, every time you get a bill, if you don't look at that stuff, look carefully. There's always charges you never expect. There's unexpected overages and hidden fees, but at Mint, the plans start at only $15 a month. And they make it so convenient because you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan. You bring your own phone number and, of course, all your existing contacts. So are you ready now to say yes to saying no, to no more contracts, no monthly bills, no hidden fees anymore, no more BS? If so, make the switch at mintmobile.com/undisclosed. That's mintmobile.com/undisclosed. Upfront payment of $45 required, equivalent to $15 a month. Limited time new customer offer for the first 3 months only. Speeds may slow above 35 gigabytes on the unlimited plan. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Hi, everybody. Rabia here. I am so excited to tell you, if you haven't heard yet, that Undisclosed finally has a Patreon. Our Patreon is where you will find all kinds of perks like ad-free episodes, a bonus episode every month where Colin and I answer all your questions, and also you're going to find perks like early access to our limited merch drops, which are going to start happening twice a year, as well as the ability to get on a Zoom call with me once a month, face-to-face, to live discuss any true crime case that you guys are obsessed with and really want to go through. And I love having a place to talk about that stuff because I need people to talk about it with. But if you're not in it for the perks and you're in it for the justice and you just want to support our work, I would really ask you to please sign up for the dollar a month tier. And the perk there is just good karma and warm fuzzies and being in the fight for justice for these defendants, because if everybody chips in a dollar a month, our work can be funded for another decade to come. So check out the Undisclosed Patreon by going to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Again, it's patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And I hope to see you all there. Thank you for supporting our work for a decade, and please stay with us so we can do this for years to come.
And then we have the key issue in the Amanda Lewis trial, testimony by a surrogate scientist. In Bullcoming versus New Mexico, a forensic analyst named Kaler tested the defendant's blood sample to determine its blood alcohol concentration. By the time of trial, Kaler had been placed on unpaid leave. The prosecution, therefore, did not call Kaler, but instead a surrogate scientist named Rosados to testify about what Kaler had found and recorded. On appeal, the Supreme Court concluded the surrogate testimony violated the Confrontation Clause. Here are the pertinent portions of the Supreme Court's opinion, read by Justice Ginsburg.
We hold that surrogate testimony of that order does not meet the constitutional requirement. Surrogate testimony of the kind Rasitos was equipped to give could not convey what Kalar knew or observed about the events his certification concerned. Nor could such surrogate testimony expose any lapses or lies on the certifying analyst's part. A particular note, Rasitos knew nothing about why Kalar had been placed on unpaid leave, an issue on which cross-examination might have been enlightening.
This holding has particular pertinence to the Amanda Lewis trial, because you might recall that less than 2 months before Dr. Siebert's autopsy on Adriana, the State Medical Examiner's Commission had fired him for making, quote, material misrepresentation of data upon which an opinion or conclusion as a medical examiner is based. Justice Ginsburg's logic applies equally here. Questioning Dr. Minyard could not and did not expose any, quote, lapses or lies by Dr. Siebert during his autopsy of Adriana. And, as Justice Ginsburg noted in Bullcoming, another issue with testimony by surrogate scientists is that the jury might not learn of other misconduct by the expert performing the underlying testing. Well, as we explained last episode, this was a huge issue in the Amanda Lewis trial, and the jury definitely didn't learn about Charles Siebert's shenanigans. Neither Dr. Minyard nor Dr. Willey testified to them. But they did come up during the testimony by his assistant, Lisa Ruckman.
But you didn't work for Dr. Siebert, did you?
I did.
And he's gone, right? He's no longer a medical examiner. Is that correct?
No longer in the state of Florida, no, sir.
Okay. And he's gone because the Medical Examiner's Commission found that he did sloppy autopsies. Isn't that right?
I wouldn't agree to that.
And the governor said that he lost confidence in his ability to do autopsies in our circuit. Isn't that correct?
I'm not certain if he was quoted as saying that or not.
That's all the jury heard on the issue, with Lisa Ruckman denying and deflecting the allegations against her former boss. But they were true. No, the commission didn't use the word sloppy, but they did say that Dr. Siebert was negligent and had failed, quote, to perform the duties required of a medical examiner in at least 35 of the cases they reviewed. And Governor Charlie Crist was quoted as saying that he lacked confidence in Dr. Siebert in an October 2007 article in the Tallahassee Democrat. Now, at this point, you might be saying, okay, you've cited some Supreme Court precedent on point, and the rationales in those cases could apply in Amanda's case. But how do we know for certain that Amanda's rights under the Confrontation Clause were violated? Well, Dr. Andrea Minyard didn't solely serve as a surrogate medical examiner at Amanda's trial back in 2008. That very same year, she served in the same role at the trial of a doctor named Robert Ignaziak, who is charged with healthcare fraud and related crimes. Specifically, as in Amanda's trial, Dr. Minyard testified about autopsies she did not conduct or attend. In an opinion reversing Ignaziak's convictions, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit ruled as follows. Applying the reasoning of Crawford, Melendez-Diaz, and Bullcoming, we conclude that the 5 autopsy reports admitted into evidence in conjunction with Dr. Minyard's testimony, where she did not personally observe or participate in those autopsies, violated the Confrontation Clause. In addition to the fact that the autopsy reports were admitted into evidence, Ignaziak suffered prejudice because of the significant role that the non-testifying experts played in conducting the autopsies and generating the data contained in the autopsy reports upon which Dr. Minyard based her opinion. That Dr. Minyard may have briefly expressed her own independent agreement with the non-testifying medical examiner's conclusions regarding cause of death only compounded the Confrontation Clause error that occurred. Because Dr. Minyard had neither performed nor been present during the autopsies in question, she was not in a position to testify in cross-examination as to the facts surrounding how the autopsies were actually conducted or whether any errors, omissions, or mistakes were made.
Unfortunately, any appeal of this issue has been waived at this point because Amanda's former attorneys didn't raise it in prior appeals. But yep, there was exactly the same issue in that case as in Amanda's case. So in what ways did Dr. Minyard independently agree with Dr. Siebert as she had done with the doctor in the Ignazia case? Let's go point by point. First, let's start with a key part of Dr. Minyard's independent opinion.
I believe that this child was in a struggle and that a caretaker or whomever inflicted these bruises. I also believe and know for a fact that the child was found submerged in the swimming pool.
During redirect, Dr. Minyard was even more explicit.
In my opinion, when I have unexplained injuries, that usually means violent struggle.
This prompts 2 points. First, as we noted in an earlier episode, there are huge questions about whether Amanda could have drowned Adriana from outside the above-ground pool. Second, if she had done so, her shirt would have been sopping wet from the pool wall collapsing while she was doing the drowning. It wasn't, and that shirt was also a t-shirt. This leads to a third point you may be wondering about, which is that no, Amanda had no scratches or bruises on her arms. And so you can see how this all came together in defense counsel's closing argument.
Amanda Lewis never went inside the swimming pool. Nobody's ever said that. AJ says she was outside the swimming pool. So how can you drown somebody from the outside of a swimming pool, especially this swimming pool where it bulges out at the sides? And if you mash on the liner, on the inflatable ring, it goes down and the water comes over the top. It would be impossible. Even a 6 or 7 year old child is going to struggle. I mean, that's Dr. Siebert's whole theory, is that there's a struggle here. Well, a 6 year old child's going to struggle and scratch and get away. How in the world is Amanda Lewis going to drown her daughter standing outside the swimming pool? It's a physical impossibility.
And guess what? This theory that Adriana would have scratched or bruised the arms of someone trying to drown her is not something defense counsel created in closing argument. Early in the investigation, Chief Deputy Harry Hamilton thought that Allen Jr. might have drowned Adriana. You might recall that Allen Jr. was a 14-year-old son of Amanda's boyfriend, Allen Carnley, and that he had arrived at his father's trailer the night before the drowning. And so when Allen Jr. was brought in for investigation, Deputy Hamilton had Allen Jr. show him his arms, lift his shirt, and spin around in a circle.
Let me ask you something. Just to clear everything up. Mm-hmm. If somebody put Amanda in that pool, she probably struggled with them. And probably would have bruised them at some point in time. Mm-hmm. Would you mind lifting your shirt up for us to see if you got any bruises or scratches or anything on you?
That's been this scar.
Let's see. Turn back around this way. Come on around. Okay. You don't have a clue.
I don't have a clue.
And so, no, neither Allen Jr. nor Amanda had scratching or bruising on their bodies or arms that you would expect if they had fatally drowned Adriana in the pool.
Hey, Central Ohio! The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners!
This takes us to a second part of Dr. Minyard's testimony, which were some of the injuries on Adriana. This was the presence of petechia, or dot hemorrhages, in her eyes. These hemorrhages were the biggest basis for Dr. Siebert's conclusion that Adriana was the victim of a homicide rather than an accidental drowning. But for Dr. Minyard, they were not important in forming her opinion that this was a homicide.
Yes, the dot hemorrhage in the eye. I did not want to show a picture of that because as far as my testimony today, I'm not even considering that injury because it can be caused by many different types of things. If you vomit really violently, you can get little hemorrhages in your eye. If you cough violently, you can get these. I would imagine if you're having CPR with chest compressions, that you could get these tiny hemorrhages in your eye. So I don't know what caused those hemorrhages in her eye, so I felt it was best not to dwell on those injuries of the eye.
This is pretty huge. Here we have the surrogate medical examiner concluding that the biggest basis for Dr. Siebert's conclusion that it was a homicide was, in fact, no big deal. And her conclusions were echoed by defense pathologist Dr. Edward Willey, who again gave remote testimony that's tough to hear.
The TTI that are examined, seen in circumstances like that, for example, people in breath hold, and exhale against a closed glottis will develop the TTI quite commonly. And so you don't know the mechanism. It doesn't necessarily require asphyxia. We have lots of people that are alive that have had the TTI.
Can they be caused by violently coughing or vomiting?
Yes, they can be.
How about in just a pure drowning event with a child? Can you still see petechiae in a pure drowning case?
Well, as a matter of fact, Dr. Siebert seems to indicate in his deposition that that's a reason for thinking that it's homicidal in distinction to accidental is the presence of petechiae, because he thinks they don't occur in accidental drownings of children. And I would have not had a basis for disputing him other than to say that I don't think there's any evidence to that effect, were it not for a recently published article by Summers et al. In Forensic Science International, which reports a number of cases, I think 79 or so, children that have drowned in accidental circumstances, and a significant number of them had petechiae. So I think it's safe to say that that's not a reasonable method for distinguishing accidental from non-accidental drowning.
Okay, so based on the current state of the art in pathology, there is at least one study that documents petechiae in children who have drowned.
Yes. More than that, I think in my deposition, if I'm not mistaken, I was asked about an article. Let's see. Located that.
I never got this.
One by Hood and another author and Spitz. And they indicate that petechiae can occur in all sorts of circumstances, too.
Okay, that's, we have the article by Summers, Chiasson, and Taylor, and now you're...
The one I provided.
Okay, is there another one out there that...
Yes, there are others as well, and then there's Eli and Hirsch, which is a classic article that indicates that it's principally the forces that produce the ATI. It has nothing necessarily to do with asphyxia.
Okay, so... Based on articles in peer-reviewed journals, there is evidence that children who drown have petechiae, even though they're and these are accidental drownings, not homicides.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Stated correctly.
In case you couldn't catch all that, Dr. Willey was saying that the historical understanding was that petechiae in a child drowning victim was strong evidence of foul play. But a handful of new studies called into question that common wisdom, reporting on many cases in which petechiae were present in accidental drownings. And this is exactly where Dr. Minyard and Dr. Willey both concluded that Dr. Siebert's core claim that this was a homicide due to the presence of petechiae was no longer supported by the science. This, of course, leads to the million-dollar question that nobody knows. Would Dr. Siebert stand by his conclusion based on the shift in the science? And this is exactly why the Confrontation Clause says that Amanda had the right to confront him at trial. This takes us to a third part of Dr. Minyard's testimony, which is that she did agree with Dr. Siebert that this was a homicide, but for different reasons. Let's start off with the first of those reasons. Namely, Dr. Minyard found A.J. Hutto to be a credible witness who implicated his mother in the murder.
There is, in my opinion, a credible witness which describes how the decedent came to be in the swimming pool. And based on the statements of the witnesses, the circumstances of the investigation, and the autopsy, I believe this to be a homicide.
But should a medical examiner be basing her conclusion on cause of death on her take on a child's credibility? This is a topic that came up when prosecutor Larry Basford cross-examined defense pathologist Edward Willey.
What, if any, weight do you give to the statement of A.J. Hutto to law enforcement, sir?
Well, I guess not the weight one to evaluate any statement by a child. I don't have any special ability in that. I don't have any special training at it, and I'm not the appropriate person to do that.
And you wouldn't qualify that just by saying a child. You would go as far as saying you're not qualified to evaluate the credibility of an adult either, right, sir?
No, I think that's very difficult to determine credibility unless you've got some manner of verifying objectively. I'm aware that people think they can do that, but as a generalization, I'm skeptical, and I know I can't do it very well.
You may agree with me, sir, that honesty is not something that you can determine by age.
That's correct. Young people can be truthful, and young people can be untruthful, and old people can be truthful, and old people can be untruthful.
And you would agree that it would ultimately be, in this case, it should be up to the jury to decide whether or not A.J. Hutto is a credible witness or not?
Well, there are undoubtedly people that have a much better basis for judging what children say and do and that sort of thing than I. For example, I suggest possibly psychologists can do that, possibly child psychiatrists can do that.
And in case you're wondering, yes, AJ was evaluated by a child psychologist, and we'll discuss his findings in a future episode. But regardless of those results, this is where Dr. Minyard and Dr. Willey differed. According to Dr. Willey, the physical findings in the autopsy would be consistent with either an accidental drowning or a homicide. And therefore, as a pathologist, the forensic evidence was not enough to conclude this was a homicide. Instead, Dr. Willey claimed that Dr. Siebert only came to his conclusion based on confirmation bias from the feedback loop of AJ's police statement and Adriana's injuries. And defense counsel didn't exactly have to extract this take by Dr. Willey.
I think I've covered everything. Is there anything that you think that I've missed that you want to comment upon regarding the autopsy findings in this case?
The only issue you may wish to address is a certification of a manner of death homicide.
Okay. Let's touch on that. Dr. Siebert opined, based on all the information he was provided to him, that this drowning occurred by way of homicide. And just let me ask you, generally speaking, are drownings generally homicides? Are they accidents? Or what would be the normal manner of death in a drowning case?
Most drownings are accidents and not homicides. On the other hand, there are homicidal drownings. And in this case, I don't see anything in the physical findings and autopsy that compel that interpretation. The reason for thinking that is a statement of the witness, which I really cannot evaluate. I just have no idea how to evaluate the statement of the young child.
Right. Well, we have a drowning case, and we have an eyewitness who watched it happen, and certainly within the discretion of the medical examiner to rule it a homicide as opposed to an accident. Is that accurate?
I wouldn't criticize him for making that decision.
Another medical examiner could look at these same findings and rule it an accidental drowning.
Well, if he were to have these findings and not have such a suggestive history, which produces a confirmation bias in everything that's done after the history is acquired, he might very well come to a different conclusion.
So, why did Dr. Minyard agree with Dr. Siebert that this was a homicide? For Dr. Minyard, there was one other key factor that caused her to come to this conclusion.
And again, these very prominent, discolored, very large bruises. And you'll notice that they are on different sides of her forehead. Her forehead is not a flat piece of countertop. Her forehead is rounded. And these bruises are on different planes of that rounded head.
Is that significant?
Yes, it is significant. When we look at children's bruises, when they fall on their foreheads, and they do, they fall on their foreheads at times, they'll have a bruise on one plane, and by plane I mean imagine this piece of my skin being part of a straight sheet of paper going out this way and going out this way. That bruise will be right here because that's the surface that hits the floor or the countertop or the corner of the table or what have you. So you'll have the bruise on one aspect of the head. When you have bruises that go around on both sides of the head, that's a little more difficult to explain away as an accidental type of injury or accidental fault.
Two things to note here. First, Dr. Minyard consistently claimed that it was these facial bruises in combination with the credible claims by AJ against his mother that allowed her to come to this conclusion. But there's a problem with this. In his police statement, at trial, and in his drawing, AJ claimed that his mom drowned his sister in the soft-sided pool. The whole theory that Adriana's bruises came from Amanda's hand was premised on her pushing the back of Adriana's head against the hard surface of the pool. As we've noted, when Dr. Siebert was presented with this problem during his deposition, he had no answers.
How would you have an object there to press against in order to get enough force to cause a bruising?
Yeah, I don't know if it's possible. It doesn't look like from this picture that you can actually reach the bottom of the pool. I don't know.
And Dr. Willie was also seriously skeptical of this theory based upon the pool being soft-sided and flexible.
It's difficult for me to visualize how he intends that to be taken because there are pictures of this pool. And it's a relatively flexible and weighted pool, so there isn't a higher surface to push on.
Unfortunately, defense counsel never asked Dr. Minyard about how AJ's story and Dr. Siebert's theory could line up based upon the fact that Adriana was drowned in a soft-sided, flexible pool. That said, I'm not sure this would have caused her to change her conclusion that the cause of death was homicide. And that's because Dr. Minyard simply felt that she lacked any good faith basis for Adriana's bruises.
I see these injuries as not being explained properly by anyone, including caretaker or emergency medical technician. These are injuries that would need to be explained for me to understand why and how they got there.
But speaking of good faith, this takes us back to episode 5 and the prosecution's boat made of mud. I reached out to Dr. Minyard in connection with this podcast. She graciously agreed to speak with me, but said that anything she said would be strictly off the record. And so, I sent her the testimony she gave, including her testimony about the prosecutor gave her in preparation for her testifying about the cause of death as a surrogate medical examiner.
Dr. Minyard, have you had an opportunity to review the autopsy file, the official autopsy file of Adriana Hutto?
Yes.
In addition to that, what other documents or information have you reviewed before testifying today?
I reviewed the materials in the file. I also reviewed Holmes County Sheriff's Department report. I have interviewed a statement letter by Dr. Willie. I reviewed the pictures of the autopsy, also pictures of the scene, the crime scene, which is the scene of the death, and I reviewed taped interviews with A.J. Hutto and Alan Michael, and I think it's Alan Michael Carnley.
Have you had an opportunity to review a deposition of Dr. Willie?
Yes, Dr. Willie's deposition as well.
So, recall that Dr. Minyard testified that she saw no reason to believe that Adriana's bruises were caused by the emergency medical technicians. And, as you just heard here, Dr. Minyard reviewed Michael Raley's investigative report in preparation for her testimony. As we noted in Episode 5, Michael Raley wrote the following in his report.
Major Hamilton and I also conducted a videotape interview with Esto Fire Chief Charles Corcoran. He demonstrated the techniques he used to attempt to resuscitate Adriana. He stated that he should not have caused any trauma or injuries to her forehead.
This was what the prosecution gave Dr. Minyard to review. Now, notably in her testimony, Dr. Minyard does not mention being given the videotaped reenactment of the techniques that Chief Corcoran used in Adriana that was referenced in this report. To refresh your recollection, here's the key audio of that reenactment.
Now, when you picked her up, her head would stay on the ground like this?
Yes.
Okay,
wanted
she never
gravity to work for me.
Okay. Did her forehead ever come around in contact with the ground?
I am going to say yes in the process.
Okay. Was there any, when she was like this, there any blows or anything that would cause any trauma to her head?
Yes, I did give her back blows initially to clear anything that was there. There was that combination of vomitus, and it was in that afternoon point. I thought there could even be food stuck in there, and I did give her at least 4 back blows in the sequence of trying to clear it out.
And so, this is what I passed along to Dr. Minyard. I told her that she was misled by the prosecution as much as the jurors were, because despite what was relayed in Mike Aurelia's report, Chief Corcoran clearly said in his reenactment that the 4+ back blows he delivered to Adriana while her forehead was against the ground would have caused trauma to her head. This isn't to say that we can say with any certainty that this is what caused the bruises to Adriana's head, but it's at least a possible explanation, especially given that Adriana only had that one small circular bruise in her forehead when the first responders arrived. Now, as noted, Dr. Minyard made clear that any response she had to what I revealed to her was strictly off the record. But I was able to contact another medical examiner who was willing to go on the record and who had a very specific theory regarding the bruises in Adriana's head. And she's someone familiar to anyone who's followed this podcast since the beginning. Dr. Lee Lavati, a medical examiner with the Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office for over 25 years and a professor of pathology at the Wayne State University School of Medicine. I first spoke with her 10 years ago for the Adnan Syed case.
Yeah, what I would like to say is that, I mean, it's been 10 years since we first met and did the first podcast episode together. And as you know, I had a lot of concerns and was very trepidatious about doing that, mainly because since I testify a lot, my concern was that something that I said on the podcast could be edited in a certain way and taken out of context. But you showed that that absolutely did not happen. My answers were put out there in their entirety, and it was an incredibly positive experience for me.
The response to her appearance on our podcast was so great that Dr. Lavati started her own podcast to educate the public on pathology and how autopsies are and should be done.
We could do a podcast. You know, we could do something educational. And so then I Googled medical examiner offices and saw that no one else had a podcast. And knowing what the talents of my team are and their interests, I knew that I could sell them on this. And so we put together our podcast, and it is called Detroit's Daily Docket. And it was mainly just educational. Like, each episode was a different topic, and it was educational and using nationally known cases where the autopsy reports were public record. And it was a lot of hard work, but we got such a great positive feedback from the public, from the medical community, and from the forensic community.
Finally, after signing with their new academic partner, Wayne State University, Dr. Lavati and her team are working on a second season of the podcast and have started an Instagram feed that further educates the public on pathology.
Right now, what we do have is an Instagram page. It was created at the same time as the podcast and has been running all the time. And it is at Detroit's Daily Docket. It's a little different from the podcast in that the Instagram page is really more an atlas of pathology images. We have such an amazing wealth of material here, not just injuries, but diseases and conditions that you would think, you wouldn't even think you would still see in a major urban city. So once a week, there is a new case, and it is autopsy photos and microscopic images. And anyone who has ever tried to look up pictures of autopsy findings online knows that there's really nothing out there. So this is really a very valuable resource that both our medical and our forensic communities have really embraced, and we thoroughly enjoy doing. So if your listeners want to see what a lot of these findings look like, we certainly direct them to our Instagram page.
Turning to the work that Dr. Levati did for us in the Amanda Lewis case, we should start with a disclaimer. And that is this. We have very little medical evidence in this case. In fact, we have submitted FOIA requests to Florida that have come up empty so far. And so, the limited evidence that Dr. Levati had to review is all we could give her. On the other hand, as you listen to my interview with Dr. Levati, you'll see a stark difference between how she and Dr. Siebert reviewed this case. And so, let's see what she had to say.
Just so that we're very clear about what I reviewed, I was given the autopsy report. I was given transcripts of the testimony of the ones that I mostly focused on was the medical examiner who testified at trial, the defense expert's pathologist, as well as the transcripts from the first responders and the ER doctor who treated her and eventually pronounced her dead in the ER. And two photographs total. One was of the pool in the backyard, and the other one was an autopsy photo. So I was only shown one photo. That photo, just so that everyone understands, was only of the top left portion of her head. So it showed her forehead and the side of her head, and there was no ruler or scale. And the other facial injuries that were described in the report were not in that photo. So as we're going forward, what we'll really be talking about when we say facial injuries is really just the three linear bruises on her forehead. Now, when I reviewed all of that, I think the cause of death is not in dispute. The girl drowned. But the manner of death, I never would have called it homicide. I can't imagine, at least in this jurisdiction and in this office, there are certain things that we would have done that were not done in this case. But I think ultimately at the time, it probably should have been ruled indeterminate manner because the investigators, they had a witness. So they could not entirely rule out foul play. So when that happens, you have to respect that even if the autopsy really doesn't seem to indicate foul play. And certainly today, if I was reviewing this case, that is still what I would say for the manner of death.
And when you mentioned how your office would have done things differently, can you speak to specifically if this case came across your desk, how you would have handled it?
Certainly. I think there's two ways, but the most important one is I've been here for 26 years in one of the busiest offices, and I've personally autopsied like over 10,000 cases. I stopped counting, and I've testified over 500 times. And what all that experience has taught me is that every death is literally different, and the slightest changes in autopsy findings or circumstances can make a huge difference in how you're going to conclude the cause and manner of that death. And every day you have to have a very high index of suspicion and good common sense, because when a case comes across your autopsy suite, and as you're looking at the body and the findings there, and you're hearing the story, if it doesn't make sense, and you are internally going, huh, that what that means is you absolutely have to go to the scene and reenact the death. That's separate from the scene investigation. I mean, the investigator from the office hopefully will have gone and looked at the scene. Certainly the police can give you what their investigation of the scene is. This is something different. So in this case, looking at this girl and seeing those bruises and then hearing that a witness said that this child was dunked and that could be a hand imprint, I never would have thought that that was a hand imprint for reasons that we'll talk about. But most certainly, I internally would be extremely doubtful. So this is an absolute, you go to the scene. If the pool has already been drained, you fill it back up, and you can use either a soccer ball or a mannequin head. But basically, go to that pool and try to recreate the circumstances as it was told to you while paying attention to injuries that you would be causing to the face while doing it. And that's absolutely vital, and that was not done here. When you're at the scene, if the reenactment went as I think it would, and as we will be talking about, you would then realize that those injuries likely came from something else. And because you're there at the scene and you know what injuries you're talking about, you can start processing it, looking for things that could have caused the pattern injury on her face.
And on that point, with what you're speaking to regarding this theory by the state, which is that it is the mother Amanda's left hand that caused the bruising on the face that you saw in the photo, which is the only autopsy photo we have, you did a reenactment yourself. And so can you speak toward that reenactment and what it led you to conclude regarding this theory about the hand causing this bruising?
Certainly. So actually what you're referring to is more like an experiment. So Although I think it was absolutely mandatory for an office to do a scene reenactment of this case, we sort of here go the extra mile and we do experiments. Now, to be clear, these experiments are not to determine the cause of death. These are cases in which the autopsy findings, the like toxicology findings, you know, actual objective data, hard medical science is what the cause of death is. But we conduct experiments to try and address questions that maybe the autopsy can't answer, or just to dispel rumors. I mean, I think if the investigators can see what we're talking about, it makes it much easier for them to understand what we're saying. So in this case, I don't have the pool, and I really hope one of your listeners has a similar pool and can reenact dunking a ball and let us know what that actually looks like. And I'm sure we'll be talking about what I think that would look like. But I had red spray chalk paint at home and a mannequin head. I decided to see what would it look like if you were to grab a face. And if you don't mind, I think we have to back up just a little bit to talk about basic wounding properties so that we're all on the same page before we get to dunking it at the scene, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. So first of all, if you take your flat hand and put it against a flat surface, like a table, and you push, the table is providing resistance. And when you push, you feel that your force is transmitted pretty evenly through your hand. So in other words, you're leaving a handprint that will include the fingers because it's a flat hand against a flat object that is giving you some resistance back. Now, if you go to push on a curved surface, and I'll use a soccer ball here as the example, you can't keep a flat hand on the curved ball because you are not controlling its movements by doing so. So your hand will curve to the surface, and in essence, you're going to end up gripping the ball. That is how you can exert control over the movement of this round object. And when you do so, grab a soccer ball. Where your force is transmitted is not entirely through your hand. It's through your fingertips and through the base of your fingers at your palm. While your fingers might be touching the ball, there's no force coming from that. So if you were injuring that ball, if that was possible, you would see fingertip marks and you would see injuries around near the base of your fingers, but you wouldn't see linear bruises. So now let's move on to the force needed. There's no way to actually measure this because there's no way for us as a forensic pathologist. But if you slap someone or if you push them, you're likely not to cause any injuries. But if you punch them, certainly. Now you're going to cause facial injuries. So it really comes down to resistance to you pushing. So if you're pushing an object, like say the ball, in air, there's no resistance in the air. You will leave no injury whatsoever. You may still be able to push the ball, but you're not able to create any injuries. In the water, it's pretty much the same thing. The water gives you a little bit more resistance, but it still is not providing like what a firm surface would, so that you're really pushing against something. So again, if you were just pushing on the face in water, you would not be leaving these injuries. The only way to leave these injuries would be to push the head against a firm surface. Mm-hmm. So now that we know that, take a look at the pool. Now, my photograph, I think, was a little different than the one that is on your Instagram page in that there is a woman kneeling off to the side and there's some resuscitation equipment way in the periphery of it. But I see that pool, and I see a pool that has very flexible sides and looks about, the sides look about 4 feet tall.
Yes.
And there is a red metal wagon next to it. And so I know that that material, I know that pool's not made of rubber, but it's another synthetic material that can withstand the chlorine and the direct sunlight. But if you push onto the side of that pool, it will move, it will bend, and water will come out. So I have to tell you, I am 5'10", and I know that if I was standing at that pool, and I was going to dunk the ball in the pool, and I had to, at first I have to find the firm surface to push it against so that I'm leaving any injuries on the face whatsoever. And the side of the pool will not provide that because, again, it's flexible. It will move. It will bend. So the only firm surface that you can push is to the bottom of the pool, to the ground. And at 5'10", I think I could bend over and probably be able to do that, but my arms, my head, my hair would be in the water, and likely my chest too. And I know my body would be pressing against the side of the pool, and it would be partially collapsing. So in order for me to at least reach the ground and push something into it, I would be completely soaking wet like I was in the pool, and a lot of that water would no longer be there. I think if anyone was more toward the 5 foot height than the 6 foot height like myself, you might even have to be entirely into that pool. You might not be able to push something into the bottom of that pool from the outside. But certainly how the mother looked, and how much water was around the pool and not in the pool, that's something that you would instantly see at the scene. And I also think that while you're doing that, you can be very aware of the pressure that you're placing. And again, when I'm doing that, it's not my fingers that are pressing against the head with all the pressure, because I'm trying to control that object and not let it move, so that it would not be leaving linear bruises on the forehead.
Right. That's all great background. Absolutely. And it's consistent with a lot of the reporting we've done that hasn't aired yet in the podcast. So thank you for that. And then all that sets up the experiment that you did. And so, as you said, with this paint and the ball, what was this experiment that you conducted?
So in this case, I thought, okay, with this head, I have the paint, I'm going to paint my hand entirely. So I completely covered it in the paint, and then I pushed the head into the ground. So, and doing so with positioning my hand so that the fingers would be on the forehead. And I did this multiple times, and at no time did I ever get any linear marks from the paint on the forehead from my fingers. It was all where my fingertips were and where the base of my fingers were. So to me, it's a very simple experiment, but I think it really shows exactly what I'm saying here today.
Got it. And so that's consistent with what I've seen in the research and some testimony, which is to say, a lot of people say these grab mark bruises in the circumstances you're speaking to are more oval or circular, corresponding with the fingertips as opposed to linear. That's kind of what you found with the experiment.
Exactly, yes.
Got it. And then secondarily, as you noted, and as we've said, there is this red wagon that is pulled up to the pool. And so what were your thoughts and what did you do regarding seeing that wagon there next to the pool?
So if I was at the scene and had reenacted it and it went according to how I think, that means now I have a patterned injury on multiple planes of this girl's head that needed to be explained. And I'm at the scene. So I would have looked around, had the investigators with a picture of what I'm talking about with a scale. So that opportunity was missed, but I think that the wagon is the most likely object. And I'm not just saying that because it was the only other thing in the photograph, but wagons have, like the upper rim of the wagon, is metal, but it's folded over. If anyone ever looks or Google what a red metal wagon looks like, and knowing that if anything that would strike that wagon, a linear mark or bruise would be created. So I had a wagon in my garage. So on Labor Day, much to my, unfortunately, my neighbors having a barbecue. They know that they live next to a forensic pathologist and that we're weird like this, but put the wagon in my backyard, sprayed it with the paint, and then dropped the mannequin head repeatedly. And this is why I love doing experiments. I thought it would be the upper edge, and it turns out that, yes, the upper edge would cause a bruise, but only one. Mm-hmm. There was no way that I could drop that head that would give me more than one bruise. But when I had the mannequin head down in the wagon, so I put her down, face down, side of her head against the side of the wagon so that she wouldn't roll around, and this is when I was spraying the other side of the wagon to continue doing experiments, I picked up the head, and now I had multiple linear bruises. What I didn't know, and I can't because that wasn't in the picture of the wagon, but the inside of the wagon, which is called a bed, has ribbing. So the manufacturers called this a ribbed bed. So it's like ridges. And the ridges run longitudinally along the bottom of the wagon to increase its strength and to help prevent warping. So these are just like little raised, like rows or ridges. And when you picked up the, so what I realized when I was doing these experiments that you would get the linear marks from the ribbing on the forehead. It could also cause injuries on the nose because that's on the same plane of the face that would be contacting the ribbing. You also got a linear bruise on the side of the head where it was contacting the side of the wagon. So now with one act of accidentally dropping her head into that wagon, likely as she was being taken out of the pool, we now have linear marks on both planes of the head and in the same locations where the ones in the photograph. It also caused a small mark on the left cheek because the cheekbone was in the same plane of the head that was touching the side of the wagon. Now, admittedly, my wagon, as I then had to, of course, come in and Google what ribbed beds of wagons look like, and I saw that manufacturers all have different ones. So there are some that have very narrow ridges and they're more closely spaced, and then others, like the one I have, it's like a more broad sort of ridge, and it's like about an inch and a quarter to inch and a half wide. So it's thicker, it's wider, but there's few of them in the bottom of the wagon. So when I used the mannequin head, I could only get two linear bruises, the one on the side of her head from the side of the wagon, and then the one where the head first contacted this rib. But the mannequin head is hard plastic. So if it was a human head with skin, I would fully expect there to be two linear bruises on her face from contacting the bed of the wagon, and then one on the side of her head from contacting the side. And so I demonstrated that, and I know it, and I sent you the pictures, but mm-hmm. I think that it shows that the wagon is way, that I can't produce the injuries using a hand, much less, I think, actually able to dunk the head and push it into the bottom of the pool, but that another object like that wagon certainly is way more likely to have caused the linear injuries on her face.
Got it. Is there anything else about this case or your review of it that you think is important to share?
No, I think it really shows the importance of doing things like scene reenactments. I know that my experiments might be a little bit more out there, but I have to say, for an educational purpose, those images really bring home what I'm here saying today. And I really think, I mean, I never would have thought that that was a hand imprint. I think even if someone put their hand on the forehead, I would not have gone there. And I wanted to be clear that I know that the girl drowned. That's her cause of death. Mm-hmm. Someone could have Right. been holding her underwater. I mean, you could grab clothes, you could grab hair, you could simply just push down without leaving these injuries. I do not think that these facial injuries indicate what everyone thought at the time, and it is from something else, and I think the wagon is the most likely culprit.
Summing all that up, first, like Dr. Willie, Dr. Levati sees Adriana's cause of death as indeterminate rather than as a homicide. Second, Dr. Levati never would have thought that Adriana's facial bruises were from a hand from the get-go. Third, when seeing that the pool in which Adriana drowned was soft-sided, it was even clearer for Dr. Levati that Adriana's facial bruises could not have come from a hand. Fourth, to buttress her beliefs, Dr. Levati conducted an experiment and found that gripping Adriana's face would have produced the oval type of fingerprint bruises that previous experts we cited on the podcast said would result. Fifth, Dr. Levati critiqued the work done by Dr. Siebert. All she knew at the time was that he had not visited the crime scene. What she did not know was that he didn't even know the type of pool that Adriana drowned in until his deposition. And finally, sixth, Dr. Levati thinks that the wagon that was pulled next to the pool was the likeliest cause of the linear bruises on Adriana's forehead. In the end, it now seems clear that one of the two grounds for Dr. Minyard finding this to be a homicide no longer holds water. At worst, the physical evidence of Adriana's injuries is ambiguous, meaning that her cause of death is indeterminate. At best, we now have a few other options for those injuries, either of which are much more compelling than Lisa Ruckman's hand theory, which was destroyed during Dr. Siebert's deposition. That then leaves the question of AJ's credibility as a witness. Next time on Undisclosed.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. As you know, we did something new a few months ago by utilizing SpeakPipe as a way for you guys to leave us voice notes. For anyone new here, you can go to speakpipe.com/undisclosed to leave us your questions or thoughts and comments. Since the response to SpeakPipe has been so amazing, we've got two additional exciting announcements to make. First, we have a new Facebook community group where you can engage with us and one another about all things true crime and criminal justice. Just go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer three simple questions and you're in. In addition to that, we also just relaunched our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. So many folks have already signed up, and we can't express our gratitude enough to each and every single one of you. Even a dollar goes a long way and allows us to do the work pro bono for our defendants. Also, I would like to give a quick shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production, as well as Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. To engage with us on social media, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. You can find us on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're new or a returning listener, you can check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our revamped website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can follow Rabia at RabiaSquared2, the number 2, on Instagram, and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for your continued support for us and for supporting our sponsors. Until next time.
Hey.
Pace Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.